The following edited podcast has been declassified by the Banzai Institute for Biomedical Engineering and Strategic Information.
Welcome all Hong Kong Cavaliers, Blue Blazer Regulars, Radar Rangers, Kolodny Brothers, and Rug Suckers to 5 Minutes of Banzai, the only podcast on the internet that discusses the W.D. Richter cult classic, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, 5 Minutes at a Time. I'm Josh Horowitz from the 5 Minutes of Trouble podcast, and together with my co-host Brett Stillo, we present you with a special 2-part series of bonus episodes of 5 Minutes of Banzai, featuring a very special guest on the show who is gracious enough to tell us about his life and experiences. We welcome to the show synthesizer guru and music composer of The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, Mr. Michael Lehman Boddicker. Michael, I mean, you were the soundtrack composer to The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. So welcome.
Oh, my pleasure, Josh. Brett, nice to be here.
A singular honor to meet a man who I've enjoyed that soundtrack so many years. So this is great.
Well, that's an interesting statement. The soundtrack while you listened to the film, right?
Of course, yes. Right.
Because there are several bootleg copies out there, just not real. They are not the soundtrack of the film.
That's right.
That has never been released. And actually, a lot of people have a lot of misinformation about that. I wanted to release it. And the gentleman who was in charge of that at the film company said, no, we're not releasing a soundtrack album.
That wouldn't have happened to have been Mr. Beagleman, was it?
Oh, no. He was an interesting character. Mm. No, Sidney was, he was, David, rather.
David Beagleman.
It was Sidney Beckerman and David Beagleman. Mm-hmm. He was an interesting character. he was actually quite enamored. He would bring over the year that I was a little over a year that I was working on this. Hmm. He was bringing people in very expensive suits over from France and from Italy to see my studio full of synthesizers and telling people that this was the future of music, and he was right on that part. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's there are a lot of synthesizers these days involved in making music for film and TV shows.
Absolutely. And I think before we really get into just your involvement in Buckaroo Banzai, I'm interested to hearing about just how you got your start in the industry and about the appeal of the synthesizer as you went through life.
Well, I fell in love with the synthesizer about 10 years too early. Hmm. So when I came out to Los Angeles as a singer-songwriter, I had demos of my songs where I played the synthesizer, and people started hiring me to play synthesizer on their songs. And I was still doing film composition when I first got here. In the first year I was here, I composed 2 films and went and did a lot of advertising as well, which I consider film scoring. There's a little bit of a different the art of, and you're gonna love this throughout the editing and the stammering that I do. I'm sorry. When I'm trying to think, I drive people crazy with this, and people call me Jimmy Stewart and but the deal is that when I came out here, I was doing the advertising and I was doing film composition and I was playing on people's records, and It expanded at the right time. I was kind of the only guy in my age group that was doing this work. One of the people I worked with at the very beginning of my career, who was very interested in, you know, new sounds on his records, was Bones Howe. And so I worked with Bones Howe on many projects, some of them that lasted as long as 6 months, but many projects. And then he hired me to do another film score, Get Crazy. That was an interesting
cool
film.
Cool movie, yeah.
And then this little quirky thing came along, and he gave me the video and asked me if I'd like to come up with some music for it. I was first asked to write the music to the trailer.
For Buckaroo Banzai,
For Buckaroo Banzai. Mm. Uh-huh. So he I'm sorry, we were talking about me, weren't we? And you wanted me to talk about me and my synthesizer working here. I'm talking about the film. Okay, so anyway, I'm not going to talk about me so much. So when Bones asked me to work on the trailer, it had been cut to a tempo. And thank God for the editor, because I can't tell you how many pieces of music I've been involved with for film where the editor cannot cut in time. Hmm. He doesn't pay any attention to the beats. He's not listening to the music, whatever, or he or she. And they, you know, there are skips and jumps that you have to deal with in very interesting ways. This, thank God, there was a real steady motion on all of the walking. Mm-hmm. And it was cut to what we would say is a click track. You know, it was cut to a click track, and they walked in tempo on every shot. So when they intercut in between the shots, they were walking in time. And when I saw it, I was really curious, because it was, you know, if you look at what is now the end of the film, that was actually a trailer done over a year and a half prior to the film being completed. So I wrote that music, and I remember very clearly the day I wrote it, a nice, bright, sunny day, and I did what I almost never do. I sat down at my piano, and I just let my mind wander with a specific purpose. I had a tempo, and the tempo, I had one of those Urey digital metronomes that's just like that. Sat it on top of my piano with a headphone plugged into it so I could hear it a little bit. And I started writing. And I actually, that one day, in about 2 hours, one and a half hours, 2 hours, went through and came up with the whole bit. And then went into the studio the next day and recorded all the parts, and it was actually rejected. It was that exact piece of music with the middle section was rejected, and I had to, I didn't actually rewrite it. I replayed it slightly differently. The ooh-ka-ka-da-da-da, ooh-ka-ka-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, before it goes in, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, wish I should have put up a piano here for us.
I remember, because I've heard various versions of the Banzai March, and there's like the one you hear in the film, and then there's one that's a little bit of an expanded version where it's got what you're talking about there. So that was the original version, then the longer one.
No.
The plot thickens. Okay.
So here we are. We've done this, it's been rejected, I've re-recorded it, and it's been then accepted. And I have completed my contract, and at this point, I'm not scoring the film.
It's right? just the trailer, yeah.
I'm just writing the music for the trailer, and I have an agreement in place for the trailer, and that agreement is that at the end of 2 years, like all of the trailers I write, the music reverts back to me. So that was very typical. And what you're referring to when you talk to the expanded version,
yeah.
And I don't know who's releasing these things. I once went to a guy, and we're talking in the day when this is a 24 track is a big deal, right? We had just gotten a 24 track. Before that time, all the work we'd done for Diane Warren and Tom Newman and Quincy Jones, Frank Sinatra, all that we did it. In fact, film scores like for Outland, I did on an 8-track machine.
Wow.
And so we'd gotten this 24 track, but it's an analog machine, and editing all these different parts together was kind of difficult. What you're hearing, the end of Buckaroo Banzai, was one performance all the way through. Right, I layered the instruments, but I played the instruments all the way through.
Now, which instruments did you use on that one? Was that all done on the Moog synthesizer, or was that different ones?
I mean, no, it wasn't all done on Moog. But I love Moog, and the Moog, the sound of the Moog is integral to this score.
Yeah.
But so. If I can complete that one thought about where the expanded version came from, the expanded version came from somebody that I hired to take the bits and pieces of the two different versions and turn it into a disco version. What I'd wanted was a four on the floor kind of disco version of Buckaroo Banzai.
Oh,
now,
that's great.
That should be only in my archives.
Yeah.
So this means that an employee, probably a disgruntled employee, went into my archives and stole something out of there and possibly has released it. But I think that they probably only did most of the things that I've heard of the soundtrack are released off of cassette. They're actually a cassette that's been transferred to a CD,
right?
And sometimes to a gold CD that only has the left channel working.
Questionable quality on some
for
of these,
for
sure,
25 bucks, you know.
Yeah.
but so that's the story behind the extended version.
Huh.
So I had asked for a disco compilation. But now getting back to the musical instruments involved, I wrote the initial theme on my, I had a 9-foot Steinway, still kick myself because I ended up with three grand pianos in my house and I had to let one go, and I let go that piano. But I wrote the original theme on the Steinway, and then in the studio, my basic writing setup was either at the Rhodes, and I had a beautiful Eddie Reynolds Rhodes, and I have a one of my favorite instruments I've ever played is a Roland HP-400, which was one of the very first MIDI electric pianos. So it's an electronic piano.
Sure.
And I had it actually going out, the MIDI going out to two other synthesizers. And that's the basic sound that I played all the way through for the a bulk of the score, like particularly when you'd hear, right? If you hear that little thing somewhere in the body of the score or under Penny's theme, like that's just a, that's the HP 400 with a couple of smaller synthesizers, the JD 800s.
That brings up a quick little question that I have. So that three tone, you know, da na na. I mean, you know, it's basically the Overthrusters theme. I mean, eventually Alan Howarth ended up, I guess taking what you had done and then making that the sound effect. I was kind of wondering if it was the other way around, if maybe you had been influenced by Howarth, it sounds like you came first.
Well, I believe so. Yeah, no, I wasn't even aware. I love Alan. He's a very sweet guy and very nice guy. I wasn't aware that he worked on Buckaroo Banzai. I'm sorry. The sounds of the Lectroids and stuff like that were all done in my studio. We took Ken Carman, who was the music editor, and we record. He had worked himself into pneumonia, he had like this going on in his chest, and we took and we recorded him into the PPG Waveterm, which was a big deal at that time. The same instrument I used on things like She Works Hard for the Money, the beginning of that, the gunk, 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 gunk. Yeah. You know, that same instrument we took and recorded Ken into the Waveterm, and then you drop down a couple octaves and you get that of the Lectroids. That's where that came from.
So you were involved in some of the sound effects on this. That's interesting.
Oh, we did a huge amount of the sound effects.
Yeah, we actually had a chance to interview Alan Howarth, not for Banzai, but we have another podcast for Big Trouble in Little China. And he collaborated with John Carpenter on doing the music score for that one. But he did mention that he had some involvement in Buckaroo Banzai. I'm sure
there were sound effects editors. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And at that time, it was just coming to the place where sound effect editors were beginning to incorporate synthesizers in their arsenals. Before then, you'd have maybe a sound effect record, a disc, because this is pre-CD.
Sure.
Right? Pre-CD. So you have a sound effect record, or you have a library of single stripe, three stripe, or six stripe mag, which is a piece of film for the listeners who don't know what a mag is. It's the best sounding recording device ever. It was about an inch and a half wide with sprocket holes on either side, so it never got out of sync, and it had the entire surface was covered with magnetic material, so that if you had a single stripe, the entire inch and a half was what the sound was recorded onto. And on a 24 track machine, you have 2 inches, and all 24 tracks are recorded on that 2 inches. So the track space is very tiny compared to this 1 3/4 inches of a single stripe mag, and it sounds as incredible. There's nothing that's ever compared to that. The mag machine, single stripe or three stripe, even six stripe. But if you can still imagine over an inch and 3/4 having 6 lanes instead of 24 over 2, it really sounded great. So that's what the libraries were held on, and those guys would go back through their libraries, and each sound effects editor would generally pull from his library for a film. He would not be necessarily going out like today and spending weeks or months out in the middle of the desert dragging a can behind a truck, you know.
Ben Burtt.
He's fantastic, isn't he, Ben? But Alan's fantastic too. I love Alan. I see Alan all the time.
Oh, that's
great. And I don't mean to detract from his involvement, but I know that in my office, because they stiffed me for the work we did. I paid the guys for months to work on this. I paid two guys. I paid my engineer, who was John Vigren, and I don't think that John could be credited on the film because he wasn't union qualified yet. And Arnie Scholes, who was my right hand at that time, Arnie's function was I would go out and buy a new synthesizer, and I'd go into my studio and start working on a project, and I'd say, Arnie, take the synthesizer to the next room and figure out all the cool stuff that you think I'd like to do with it, and then come and show me what it does. And Arnie would come in and he would show me all these things, and then I'd get to interpret them and turn it into music. I can actually say this for a fact. We had Emulator 1, mm-hmm. and we still use an Emulator 1 on this film, but I had at about 2 years before received Emulator 1 Serial 001.
And the first one.
The first one. And the first thing I did was I used it on a Michael Jackson record. Ah. That, ooh, 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 ooh. Yeah, that's recorded. I have still the recordings of Michael Jackson, Michael McDonald, and James Ingram all singing ooh, ee, ah, oh, into the emulator, because nobody, you know, we'd never used it on a record yet. Nobody had ever heard it before. So we took and started sampling records into it. So I hear a flute passage on The Rite of Spring, and I say, wow, if I could take that and loop that little short passage and then I could play three notes of it on top of one another, it would be, you know, a really cool sound. So we'd record those. We sampled from disc, and mm-hmm. that's actually 10 years after that part of it just exploded, where people were sampling records and utilizing the records to create new pieces of music.
Hmm. Ah, it's amazing stuff. I mean, all the stuff that you worked on. I actually want to backtrack a little bit, because I am interested in knowing about your background and just how you got the start. Now, you say that you came out to L.A. Where were you from originally?
I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Some uh-huh. people would question whether I grew up or if I've grown up yet. but I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I was born into a family that owned a music store, mm-hmm. Actually owned four different locations in three different towns in Iowa. So Cedar uh-huh. Rapids, Iowa City, and Waterloo. My parents had 1,600 music students at one time, and about 900 of them were accordion players. Then we had about 300 or 400 guitar students, mm-hmm. and then the rest were drum and piano.
So your focus was then keyboard, piano mostly?
I started playing trumpet when I was about 8 years old. Mm-hmm. Again, my parents had a music store. I played tuba for a weekend. I had a valve trombone for a couple of weeks. I loved it. I never really fell in love with the clarinet. I hadn't been, Pete Fountain is about as much woodwind as I'd been exposed to. I hadn't heard of any great jazz musicians yet. And
here's a question. So, you know, having to do with synthesizer, would you say that your first introduction to the Moog was from Wendy Carlos with Switched on Bach?
Oh, no.
Even before then?
To the Moog? Oh, no. Okay. So I played trumpet.
Yeah.
And then I started playing guitar at about 9 years old. Mm-hmm. I started studying composition and orchestration at 11. And I studied piano over that time mm-hmm. a little bit, and then switched to playing keyboard almost exclusively. When mm-hmm. I was 16, I spent part of my college fund on a B3 Hammond. And Leslie, and then that's what I played 5 to 7 nights a week all the way through high school and college. Mm. So in high school, back in Iowa, where they know the value of music education. And in fact, I just was talking to somebody from the Czech Museum back there, and they were saying that it's actually very common in the older Czech families to say, "Oh, it's really nice to meet you. What instrument do you play?" You know, music is such a part of the Czech and German culture back there. Mm-hmm. And so in the school, in a public school with 2,000 students in that public school, there was a composition class, a songwriting class. And in that songwriting class, I heard an EMS synthie. Mm-hmm. And it was somebody, the guy who brought it in, who was a substitute teacher in the comp teacher, brought in a, like they made a flute sound, they made a wind sound, a tuned wind sound, and they made a bass sound. And I went, oh boy, this is fantastic. I went to the library, which I don't think most kids do anymore. So we actually had a couple of disc, like dual turntables, and we had headphones, a nice set of headphones, and I listened to Switched on Bach and Snowflakes Are Dancing. Mm-hmm. So I first became aware of the synthesizer through both Isao Tomita and Walter Wendy Carlos.
Right.
And I was completely knocked out. And then Keith Emerson, you know, came on board, and that was it, man. I went to college and I studied electronic music and 20th century composition and learned how to make all the different noises on the different synthesizers that were available to me. And actually didn't have a synthesizer at first when I was studying at the college level. We learned it all on paper. I learned about the waveforms, their harmonic content, what an envelope generator did, what signal flow was, all that on paper. And it wasn't until about 6 months after that I actually got to put my hands on a synthesizer.
I have to ask you, what did you think of some of the stuff that the Beatles were doing with synthesizers back in the 60s?
My mentor, Paul Beaver, did that. Uh-huh. He was the guy who brought the Mini Moog and the modular Moog in. Paul Beaver was the first synthesizer studio musician in Los Angeles. He did the Quincy Jones stuff with the Nova Chord, which is a kind of synthesizer. It was predecessor to the Hammond organ. It's it's more 40s than going back, the Owen Martineau started in 1928. You know, Theremin was after that, but the Nova Chord, and then Paul actually, he had a volume pedal after an oscillator, and you could change the waveform on the oscillator, and he had grease pencil marks on where the notes were, and he could play notes like it was, on a keyboard. Remember, the synthesizer was not meant to be a keyboard instrument. Strongly urged Bob Moog not to put a keyboard on it, but it made it more readily accessible for people to make music on. Right. And the sequencer, I understand from a Moog event, we had about 110 people at my house for a Bob Moog Foundation event. And the story was told that when the guy who was helping Bob, the technician who was helping Bob build these things, built at Bob's design the first sequencer, he said, "This will ruin the music industry." and you could argue that point. It's made it possible for one person to do a lot of different things, but it's kind of eliminated the ensemble feeling. You go back and listen to a John Barry score, who I worked a ton with, or a John Williams score. It's that feeling of the ensemble performing it together. You can't beat that. So one of the things that I always hoped to keep in the synthesizer work that I did, it was not like kind of wimpy or cheesy singular instruments playing a part. I always doubled up. There was never a string sound that was actually just one string instrument. Sometimes, like on a film that shortly came after Buckaroo Banzai, The Magic Egg. I would use as many instruments as I could MIDI together on the. I know that on. I know we're only talking about Buckaroo Banzai, but if we look at Milo and Otis, there was one time that I had 24 instruments hooked up playing one string sound just to try to duplicate what an orchestra sounds like, you know, a string orchestra. It's not one individual playing 60 times. It's all these different individuals playing slightly different vibratos, slightly different attacks. You know, it moves as an entity, as opposed to a singular entity.
One of the things that when I was reading up on some of the stuff that you've done, at least on Wikipedia, they mentioned this short claymation film called Mandala with Gumby creator Art Clokey that you did in 1977. And I guess, was this technically the first sort of piece that you composed for a short?
No. When I was in Iowa, I was writing, there was a little advertising house that, you know, was quite intrigued. A guy by the name of Harn Soper, who did quite well for himself out here in Redwood City. We would sit and watch advertising and analyze what they were doing. He was just absolutely instrumental in me getting started in this area. I kind of wish that I had gone about it a little differently than that, because I just started doing it. You know, with no prior knowledge. I bought a book on how to write a jingle, and that was about as much education as I had when I started doing it. When I came out here to do Mandala and the Clay Peacock with
Art Clokey.
Yeah, Art Clokey, who I had grown up watching his claymation, you know, Davy and Goliath.
Sure.
Yep.
It was the best. It was the best, and I loved the voices, and I loved the stories. And so when I came out, and I happened to run into him, and I only ran into him because a guitar player that I was working with lived next door to him and introduced me. And I had, at that time, a four-track TIAC tape machine that I'd bought while I was in college back in Iowa. And I had that out in a two-track to mix to. I don't even think I had a reverb unit at that time. Oh, I must have gotten one of those Roland Space Echoes and a Mini Moog and an ARP 2600 and I think I put an Oberheim expander on top of my ARP 2600 and I sat there with a Moviola, which if you can imagine that this is how composers back in that day, now the working environment, you had a machine that had a motor on it, had a little tiny, about a 4-inch screen, and it had you had the film which you ran through the viewer, and then you could have, in my time, you could have one piece of mag tape that would then run over a set of heads. And you pushed on a foot pedal, and it went, I swear, just like that. It was unbelievably loud. It was unbelievably noisy, and that's the way we wrote music.
An editing machine like that.
It wasn't necessarily meant to be an editing machine. Yeah. It was, but yes, people did edit on it. You ran. You know what what would I do if it wasn't the Clay Peacock? If I was doing a piece of advertising or another with spoken word, you run the dialogue out of this little. Awful, you know, people talk about the Oratones. These are like little 2-inch 2.5-inch speakers.
Like a toy speaker, yeah.
Oh, awful. And that's what you got to listen to get your work. And the entire time you had that huge racket of the motor and of the film going, you know, it was incredible. But we got it done. And actually, when you go back and you think about the simplicity of it, because there are parameters that constrain you, sometimes that increases your creativity. You know, that we had four tracks to deal with. Mm-hmm. I had to really work hard to make the four tracks sound like something.
And then the interesting thing with Mandala, actually, I've never heard of this before. They have it up on YouTube, so I was able to watch the thing. I found it was fascinating that because you can hear traces of some of the music that I've heard on one of the Buckaroo Banzai soundtracks, specifically the Eighth Dimension soundtrack, that one track that's about 12 minutes long. You hear sort of that same type of style in Mandala. And so my question is, what was your kind of impetus, your influence, that you kind of brought forward to have this type of style in the music?
Oh, for Mandala?
Yeah, starting with Mandala, yeah.
Oh, well, it was psychedelic.
Yeah.
I never did psychedelics myself, you know. I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. I drank a bit and smoked a bit in my day, but I never did any, LSD or anything like that.
Sure.
And that crowd that was making that film was way into the hippie stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I just got to be as far out as I wanted to be. And when I got to Los Angeles, I was really enamored with Spike Jonze.
Ah.
And I ended up becoming very good friends with Leslie Ann Jonze, his daughter, who now runs up in Northern California for what was Lucas's old ranch, and she runs the scoring part of that facility up there. She's just a fantastic person and a great engineer, but I would listen to Spike Jonze, and all the people I was making records with, like, are most of the time, okay, now this is tangential, okay. The people that were making records using synthesizers at that time, you either had rockers like Keith Emerson, and very many else. You know, yeah, there was Rick Wakeman and Keith Emerson. There weren't that many other people in 1973 and 74 that were using synthesizers live on stage. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to be able to remember what I was talking about. I just went back to that, and I was trying to remember all the people that I knew that were using synth. Because you remember, I mean, what, Allman Brothers using a B3 and a piano. Mm. You know, it was rare that people used claps. So here I am. I'm working with all these people on R&B records. I'm at Motown, and Motown, the people who are interested in R&B records are the most progressive arrangers. They were really interested in always having a unique sound. You go back and you listen to those records, and it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal what they did with a clavinet or a pianette along with a plucked guitar at the beginning of a Supreme song or a Temptation song. The most innovative arrangers in the business, and they were always looking for new colors. And so the Isley Brothers were very big. And I'd be working with these people on these R&B records and trying to talk them into doing something besides bow, ow, 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 to show them we can do many other interesting sounds with the synthesizer. And they would hear me listening to Spike Jonze, and they would think I was out of my mind, you know. I loved that, what he did with it. It reminded me of the sense of humor that Isao Tomita had. Isao Tomita had a tremendous sense of humor with the bow, be bow, 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 you know, all that with the the chicks and stuff. He's the little chicks in the shells. Mm-hmm. You know, when the orchestra plays it, you can imagine it. But when he's doing it, you hear the chicks in the shells.
That some of the humor that you got from people like Spike Jonze kind of comes through in some of the music that you do? I mean, I do, again, thinking back to that one really long track of The Eighth Dimension, I mean, there's like parts in there where you hear weird, like, you know, boing sound effects. And I think there's even a track at one point where you start to hear like snippets of Auld Lang Syne because they're returning home, and then it kind of gets like zipped out.
You know what? I think that you're referring to the opening segment of Get Crazy, which someone has really, and this is what's going on out there. Somebody re-released the part of the opening of Get Crazy and said it was Buckaroo Banzai because nobody's going to buy Get Crazy. They're going to buy, you know, there are a bunch of us out there that would buy Buckaroo Banzai. And so I've seen that people took my demo cassettes that have nothing to do. There's Honda commercials and all this other stuff, and they've released it and sold it for $25 as a Buckaroo Banzai soundtrack. And I'm sorry, I don't have time. I don't have time to go out, you know, and chase them down and do that, hold them to task for what they're, you know, it's essentially theft. They're stealing music of mine, mm-hmm. and selling it to people, but it's not the music that the people think they're buying.
Well, I think maybe we can start to go back into the Buckaroo Banzai score. So all we have that we can really consider official then is what we hear in the film.
That's right. Buckaroo Banzai soundtrack. There is no Buckaroo. You know, I think somebody tried, splitting it off of a DVD or something, mm-hmm. but I'm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real shame because, you know, the music is great, and certainly there are lots and lots of fans out there who have been, you know, clamoring to hear as much of this as they can. So I guess one of the questions that I'm sure people have asked is, okay, is there other stuff that would comprise, I guess, an official soundtrack that, you know, maybe one day may see the light?
Absolutely. I have it on my short list of things to do. A couple years ago, I did the pieces I'd written for Outland, which was way before Buckaroo Banzai, as was Get Crazy. And I went back to the original four tracks and put them into Pro Tools and, you know, tried to gussy them up a little bit for the CD. And because Jerry Goldsmith had written the score to Outland, and then I had written what was source music, the music in the bar. Yeah. And so I went back and redid that. I could easily make my way. I'm getting to the point in life where I'd have time to do it. It's a pretty big undertaking. Sure. I've collected things along the way. I can play you the original Hong Kong Cavaliers before I took and rescored what was underneath it. Hmm. And I think that should be some part of the Buckaroo Banzai soundtrack when it's finally released. Hmm. Mac Rausch. Mm-hmm. Who wrote the screenplay? He gave me a cassette of his songs, which I think were fantastic. I would love to track him down and get his permission to include, because I still have those songs, and that would be, I think the Buckaroo fans would love to hear those. When I got the film, it was fully an hour longer than it was when it was released. And I have all those videotapes. Huh. I have all the extra footage. Yeah. It'd be interesting to, you know, pursue this just so.
We've heard snippets from some people who have worked on the film of certain scenes that were cut out. Like, we actually got Billy Vera on, who played Pinky Carruthers, and, uh-huh. and he was mentioning some of his scenes involving a pink snow cone, and he gets electroid when he's down and stuff. I'd be curious to know just, like...
It would be great.
What sort of stuff in the extended cut?
I've got the 3/4 inches of it here, and I've still got several 3/4 inch machines. We could sometime on a weekend. It would be really interesting to do that. But I think it belongs in a DVD. Mm-hmm. You know, but so I have an extra almost an hour's worth of music.
Wow,
that wasn't included.
Huh.
Because I wrote music for almost a year before they started really going, okay, all of those fight scenes with them just running back and forth over scaffolding, yeah. you know, that we're no matter how cool the building is they're in, we have to pare that down. And they ended up getting it down to a decent standard length. But all of it I had put music to. So
now, when you were working on the score, how closely were you involved with director Rick Richter and writer Earl MacRouche on the soundtrack? I mean, do you have any good experiences, good anecdotes you can tell us about that?
I met Earl on a dub stage when the music was already finished, and he gave me, for all intents and purposes, the music was finished. The themes were there. I had already scored, like, 2.5 hours a picture, and he gave me his cassette with his songs in it, and again, terrific. I can still sing you some of them today, and it's been 34 years. I think he's a terrific talent. Rick Richter, I met a couple of times. You know, these guys were not exactly what I would call hands on. Okay, so Rick. The person I had more interface with was Bones Howe. Mm-hmm. And so I met Rick. I met Neil, but it wasn't like we were getting together in the studio and I was playing them ideas and they were going, oh, that's great. What would happen if we tried this? None of that ever happened.
It was already done at that point.
I did all this stuff and it would have been great. I would have loved to, you know, and I talked about this on the DVD. I would have loved to have, I think that there's one place where I really should have had live woodwinds and live strings on Penny's scene when she's locked up, you know, in the jail.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to have done that. You know, I think that had I actually gotten to interface a little bit more with Rick and Neil, that I would have been able to maybe coerce some of that out of them. But it was to be an all electronic score. I only hired on one tune. I had one guitar player come in on the Hong Kong Cavaliers in the nightclub
when they do Rocket 88.
Yeah, where she's crying, right? So the guitar part was played by my friend Scott, and I played all the other instruments, and I put it in a different key so that Peter Weller's trumpet part sounded hip.
Oh. You know?
I would love to show the original and then the new version of that. So,
well, Brett, I know that you really like that Rocket 88 song, and you were commenting about that before.
Just a great arrangement. You know, also the time and the place that in LA at that time it was very modern music, but there was also a little bit of a retro thing going on.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you heard what I had, what I'd gotten originally. And then what it turned into, you know, we replaced everything but the trumpet, and turned it into a much heavier piece because it was essentially jammed on the spot.
So was that your selection, or was that something that was on that cassette from Earl MacRoush that he suggested get used?
Bones Howe suggested that they do a jam in a certain key, and that was it. They just went with it, and then we had to get rid of everything. I didn't use the drums, I didn't use the bass, I didn't use any of the guitars, I didn't use anything but Peter's trumpet, because I don't know how, because I don't consider myself that kind of a theoretical genius, but I listening to it and I'm going, hey, you know what, if I just move this music by a fourth, all of a sudden what he's playing will be pretty hip. Then we just re-recorded everything, and different chord changes, different everything, just so whatever was improvised on the set by the guys was tossed.
And so they didn't actually hear any of that portion of the score. It was all put in afterwards.
Well, you heard my score.
Yours, yeah.
So if you like the 88, that was done in my little studio on Wilshire at approximately La Brea in a loft that I illegally slept in for about 7 years and worked night and day. And we had a blast there. We made a lot of great music out of that place.
And that brings us to the end of part one of our special bonus episode of 5 Minutes of Bonsai. We'll pick up our discussion with film composer Michael Boddicker in part two next week. In the meantime, please visit us at 5minutesofbonsai.com. You can also check us out on Facebook at 5 Minutes of Bonsai and on Twitter at 5 Minutes Bonsai. We also have a listeners group on Facebook called the 5 Minutes of Bonsai Bunkhouse. So please come check it out. Join today. This is still a weekly podcast. We have a couple episodes left, so please subscribe to us on iTunes so you can get new episodes every Tuesday. We're also on Stitcher and Google Play. And please rate us on iTunes and leave your highest review possible if you can. It helps spread the word about the podcast, and we really appreciate it. So that's it for this week. Thanks for listening to this bonus episode. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.